Well, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:41, and it's Thursday the 20th. Is that right? Yeah, it is. We're going to finish up chapter 3 today, and no matter what happens, chapter 3, I'll be done talking about chapter 3, no matter what, because next time I can't talk about anything, because what's happening next time on the 25th? You have a test. You have a lecture test. All right, so let's just talk about that for a second. So what do you need for this test? Yeah, I need a Scantron 882, 882E, 882ES, but not a Lobos. Don't get the Lobos form. The Lobos form has these where you have to bubble in with a pencil. It's been shaded already with an ink, and sometimes the reader has trouble trying to see where you actually bubbled in that letter. Okay, so Scantron, then of course you need a pencil, an eraser, and make sure it is a good eraser. Make a line with your pencil on a piece of paper, and if it smudges, then throw that eraser away and get a good one. Usually those white plastic ones are pretty good, but there's other ones that people showed me this semester that work pretty nice too, but you got to check it out. Picture ID is important. And I'll try to make sure that that astronomy class is out of here on time so that you can come on in. And I think I'm going to run it so that as soon as you all can come in, I'm going to make the test live. All right, so whenever, if I can open the door 5 minutes early or 10 minutes early to let you in, I'm just going to be giving you tests. So come on in and start taking the test. There'll be a live test at that time. So if you need to study for another 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and please just stay outside, okay? Okay, that will give some people extra time. How's that sound? Good. Okay. Chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6 on that test. Oh, something else. What else did I forget? Basic non-graphing scientific calculator, right? And you can't use your cell phone, even though there can be really nice calculators on there. And you cannot share pencils, erasers, or calculators. And, of course, cell phones during the test. And the test is individual effort, and it's closed notes, closed book. So it's a lot different than an online quiz. Okay, anybody have a question on that? What about questions over what we covered last time? Yeah. Okay, calculations will be for the Nernst equation and pH. I won't ask you to do any algebraic manipulation of those equations, and I'll provide the equations for you in generic form, so you'll have to know how to use them. Right? So if I give you the concentration of hydrogen ions, what would you be able to calculate? Yeah, pH. Or if I give you pH, you should be able to calculate the hydrogen ion concentration. For the Nernst equation, I'm just going to give you concentrations of ions, and you could tell me what the voltage is. I'm not going to give you voltage, and then you have to tell me what the ion concentrations are. You won't have to go backward with that one. But in any case, what kind of funny special function or button do you have to have on your calculator to work with either one of those? Yeah, you need that log button. And then to go backwards, you need, what, 10 to the X. You need that 10 power to go from pH back to hydrogen ion concentration. And if somebody reminds me, I was thinking of maybe trying to get a video on Blackboard on how to do that. Maybe I can do that. No. If that would be really cool, you got to let me know. Okay. Because I can do that in anatomy lab. I just have to barge into anatomy lab to do that because I have a camera there. Okay. All right, so let's just kind of remember what we were talking about last time in class. I'm going to flip through a number of slides right here. Oh, yeah, we talked about RNA synthesis. What kind of enzyme is necessary for RNA synthesis? Remember, RNA is a polymer, so it's got to be a polymerase of some kind, and we name that enzyme after the molecule it's building, which is RNA. So you need an RNA polymerase. In order to make, instead of RNA, if you want to make DNA, what kind of enzyme would you need? A DNA polymerase, right? Pretty similar kinds of things. All right. Tell me about control of gene transcription. How is transcription controlled? By acetylation or deacetylation, right? By taking condensed chromatin and extending it into that extended form. But then you also need a transcription factor to bind to that extended chromatin to allow that gene to be transcribed. Right, so transcription factors, if they're not available, then transcription of that gene won't take place. And sometimes there are actually combinations of transcription factors that have to join together on a gene. We're going to eventually talk about that in upcoming chapters. Okay, so I use transcription. What is that's a component of some kind of process. What kind of process? It's a step in what process? Transcription. It's a step in protein synthesis, right? Protein synthesis. And what step is it? Is it the first one or the last one? That's the first one. And how many steps are there? There's basically two. Remember those two arrows? Transcription and translation. So you should remember where these take place. Of course, if transcription is converting DNA into RNA, you know where it's taking place, because where do you always find DNA? In the nucleus, right? When it's an extended form, it's always in the nucleus. And what about translation? What's happening there? Information in RNA is being used to make a protein, right? So that's really the last stage in protein synthesis. And where does that take place? That takes place in the cytoplasm, not the nucleus. And that's really why we have RNA, because it carries information from the nucleus to the cytoplasm. And the other reason why we have RNA is because if that RNA is lost or damaged, that doesn't kill the cell, because the cell still can go back to the DNA and make more RNA from it. Unlike if DNA was being used and the DNA got damaged, then that would cause the death of that cell, right? So RNA is just a nice backup working form of that information. All right, so those are some of the things we talked about last time. Well, I guess another thing we talked about last time, was RNA synthesis and how you use DNA to make an RNA molecule. And I see it right here. So what's the overall guiding principle to make sure that these nucleotide bases in RNA have the right sequence? Right? How does RNA synthesis or polymerase know to put a particular, like how does it know to put a uracil here? At that one location. How does it know how to put a uracil right there? How does it know to put guanine right at this location? Or a uracil at this one, or cytosine at this location? It's going, base pairing rule. So DNA is being used as a template to make that RNA molecule based on those, based on the base pairing rule. Sorry, I couldn't think of another word except base, right? Sorry, I mean base in two different ways. Okay, so base pairing is done by RNA polymerase. One strand is being used as a template. The other strand of DNA is not being used. And so that strand sometimes we call the nonsense strand. And the one that RNA is being used to make, the DNA strand that RNA is being used is called the sense strand. All right, and RNA polymerase only works on the sense strand. All right, so don't forget, base pair rules provide for that exact copying of information over and over and over again. We also learned something about a genome. Genome is just all the genes that you have in your body. And those genes produce different kinds of proteins. And something kind of shocking was discovered, and that is your body can make more proteins than there are genes in your body. We used to think that it is always a one-to-one correspondence. For every protein that made in your body, there had to be a gene for it. We know that is not the case anymore. How would you explain that to somebody? How would you explain that the proteome is larger than the genome? That means that one gene doesn't make one protein, it could make many proteins. How is that possible? Yeah, because one gene on average codes for three, because of alternative splicing, right? So that's really what you would invoke to explain that. So here is a pre-messenger RNA molecule, and not all of it is used, right? There are places within this molecule that are not used. These are what we call introns, these dark areas. These are not used to make a protein. The light colored areas are. And on this pre-messenger RNA, I see three different light colored areas. These are the areas that can be used to make a protein. And they can be combined with each other once you take these introns out, to make different kinds of proteins. We could put this one down next to this one, and you get this sequence right here, and you could leave that off. That could make one protein. Or you could put this one together with that one and leave this one off. That would make another protein. Or you could put all three together. That would make another. Or you could take these end pieces, put them together. That would make even another different kind of protein, right? So depending on how that pre-messenger RNA is spliced together, then different proteins are made. Okay, let's try this once again. That might work. There's a chance. Yeah, good. Okay, so alternative splicing is an important concept that's going to explain why the genome has 25,000 genes, but the proteome has over 100,000 different kinds of proteins that your body can make. Ah, that's pretty good. So that takes us where I think where we left off last time. And here is a really nice electron micrograph of a messenger RNA and a bunch of ribosomes. Right. I think we talked about what the function of a ribosome in this chapter is. What's the function of a ribosome? Yeah, protein synthesis, right? And I would think it would be good for you to just think of the ribosome as the workbench where a protein is being made. So I see a bunch of ribosomes right here. But a ribosome doesn't know how to build the protein. It doesn't know what amino acids go next to each other. So it needs some information. And that information is carried on a really long filamentous molecule that we call messenger RNA. So I see a couple different kinds of RNA on this picture. I see ribosomal RNA making this ribosome. And then I see some messenger RNA right here, which is that contains the information on how to put amino acids together to get the exact kind of protein that the cell is looking for. Right, and so a ribosome will attach the messenger RNA on one end, and then it will make its way down reading the instructions from one end of the messenger RNA to the other. So you could either think of it as the ribosome moving through the messenger RNA or the messenger RNA moving through the ribosome when the ribosome is fixed. In this particular case, I think it's better to think of the ribosome moving down the messenger RNA. So the ribosomes are moving, but not the messenger RNA. And when that is happening, a cell can put many, many, many ribosomes on that same long stretch of messenger RNA, right? And then each ribosome is going to make one of those proteins. So here, very early on, when that protein is being made, there's just a very short sequence of amino acids. As it moves down, as the ribosome moves down the messenger RNA, it adds amino acids, and you should see this molecule getting longer and longer and longer and then longer. And then finally, that protein is going to break away from the ribosome and do whatever it's supposed to do inside the cell. So this is what we call a polysome. A polysome is one messenger RNA with many ribosomes on it, and each ribosome can make one protein. Okay, so, and this happens, what do we call that? Taking information that's in the messenger RNA and converting it into information in a protein that it's making. Yeah, it's translation. And so where was this micrograph taken? Where was this photograph taken? Inside the nucleus or cytoplasm? Yeah, cytoplasm, right? Because that's where we find all these amino acids. The ribosomal RNA is moved out of the nucleus as well as the messenger RNA is moved out of the nucleus. Okay, so here is probably the most amazing slide in the whole class, the whole course, is right here. And it says, it's not even labeled. Okay, so a lot of books call this the genetic code. This is the code that describes what amino acid belongs at a particular location in a protein that's being made. And you need actually three bases to determine one amino acid. Because you have 20 different amino acids, but how many bases are there? There's only four, right? So one nucleotide can't determine what amino acid goes there because there's only four of them, but there's 20 different kinds of amino acids. So what has evolved is a system of three nucleotides or three bases to determine one amino acid. And if a ribosome runs into a sequence right here of UCC, then that's always going to code for the serine amino acid. So serine will be placed in this growing protein at the 1, 2, 3, 4th position. Right, so you don't have to memorize this genetic code. If I ask you a question, I would provide this for you. Right, but I could ask something, what does the triplet CGA code for in a protein? What amino acid is going to be put at this location, which, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, at the 8th position, right? CGA is going to be is going to code for what kind of amino acid? It's going to be arginine, all right? So here is the code where you can decipher the amino acid, okay, to the RNA triplet. And this is going to be the triplet that's on a messenger RNA molecule. And the reason why this is a really amazing slide, because this should be labeled the universal genetic code. Okay, and what that means is that this genetic code is very true, or almost always 100% true for every organism on Earth. Okay, so bacteria would use this genetic code, and squirrels, and fish, and everything else uses this exact same genetic code, which is kind of astounding. There's not much variation in it, but scientists do like that because they use that as evidence of what kind of thinking? Evidence of evolution, right? So it doesn't prove that there's evolution, but since all living organisms are linked together with this very common thread, that is some nice evidence of evolution. Okay, so we call this the universal genetic code. So how does this come about? Well, here's some DNA, here's some RNA, and then we got some amino acids over here. So what do we call this process of going from DNA to RNA? Yeah, it's transcription, right? So how does RNA polymerase know to make something starting with an A, then a U, and a G? Okay, because on DNA, you have that exact same sequence, the mirror sequence, right? You got TAC. And what? How would you describe the relationship between TAC and AUG? What's happening there? What would you use to understand? What would you talk? How would you say? What's going on there? That, okay, how come there's an A right here and not a C or a G? Yeah, base pair rules, right? Because of base pairing rules, A is always going to base pair with thymine, right? Adenine is always going to base pair with thymine. And what's going to base pair with adenine in an RNA molecule? Yeah, it's going to be uracil, right? It's just going to switch out. So utilize base pairing rules to convert information in DNA into information in RNA. Okay, and then that information is used to make a protein, okay, and of course we call that translation. Where does translation take place? What organelle does translation take place? Okay, that, and it's in the cytoplasm, but there's an organelle especially responsible for making that protein, and that is, I'm asking you this question in a 180 degree change compared to how we usually talk about it, but we did have talked about it. What organelle makes a protein? Yeah, ribosome. Okay, so a ribosome knows how to put this particular amino acid, right, with this sequence of nucleotide bases with the help of a transfer RNA, right, which was another kind of RNA that we talked about. So a transfer RNA will be able to bind with the messenger RNA, right? There's a transfer RNA that will bind at this UAG sequence of three nucleotides. And what would you use to explain why a transfer RNA would bind to this region right here, to this UAG? For the same reason that we know that this UAG, right, would bind to ATC in DNA. What did we use to describe that? Base pairing rules, that's right. So the transfer RNA has to have the proper sequence of nucleotides so that obeys base pairing rules, and every one of these triplets right here corresponds to a typical amino acid, right? So this amino acid is serine is going to be added to this position in a protein because of base pair rules between the transfer RNA and the messenger RNA. Okay, so this RNA that I see in the second column, this is a messenger RNA molecule. And on the messenger RNA, we have something that's called a codon. The codon is just this sequence of three nucleotides. And that sequence of three nucleotides on the transfer RNA, which can bind to this region right here, is not called a codon. It's called the opposite of that, right? Because of base pair rules, that's called an anticodon. So probably you should just memorize that. And then sooner or later, you'll become familiar with it, right? Codons are located on messenger RNA. Write that in your notes. And the anticodon, something that can bind to the codon, because of base pair rules, is the anticodon, and you have that on a transfer RNA. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right, so here we have a big, long sequence of nucleotides. And each triplet right here will correspond to one particular amino acid. So UUU will then be, we'll call for phenylalanine to put in what? The third position right here in that protein that's being made. All right, so this is what we call the codon, because that determines what amino acid is going to be put into the protein. But this RNA does not have amino acids. It has to get amino acids from someplace. And it gets amino acids from a transfer RNA, right? That's the job of the transfer RNA, is to bring those building blocks, bring those amino acids to the ribosome so that the ribosome can make a protein. And how would we explain the binding of a transfer RNA to a messenger RNA? Okay, there's a sequence of three nucleotides on a transfer RNA that will match up with the three nucleotides in the messenger RNA, and what would we use to, how would we explain why these things match up so nicely? Base pair rules, right? They just happen to have the right shape, right? Okay, so these right here are on the messenger RNA. These triplets, right, UAG, since it's three nucleotides long, that's a triplet. That is what we find on a messenger RNA. So maybe put a little M right here. The reason why it's not on here, because if you have an mRNA, that always means what? That always means a codon, so it's kind of redundant. I think that's why it's not on this slide. But it's okay right now if you're redundant. Right? You put mRNA, and then by definition, that is the codon. Right? And so, in order for base pairing to happen, there has to be another RNA molecule with a sequence of three nucleotides on it that are what? Complementary to the codons. And that sequence of three nucleotides is on a transfer RNA, and we don't call that a codon, we call that an anticodon, because they bind together. All right, so messenger RNA, you have codons, and anticodons are located on a transfer RNA. And we'll see how this gets put together once again. So anytime you see messenger RNA, what should you think of? Codon. Whenever you hear that term codon, you should think of messenger RNA. They're almost synonyms of each other, right? They're really synonymous, but just a little bit different concept, not very much, right? And this is, don't forget, this is a universal genetic code. Well, let's actually build a protein, right? So where are we going to start when we build a protein? Where do we get information? We don't want to just build any kind of protein. We want to build a specific kind of protein. Where would we get that information from? Yeah, DNA, right? The DNA is like the dictionary that tells you how to spell out that protein. So here we got a big molecule, and I see it's double-stranded. All right, what can you tell me about this molecule just by the shape of it? It's DNA, right, because it's double-stranded. What's another way you could tell this is DNA besides the label? Yeah, base pair, and in particular, look for thymine. And if it's thymine, it's got to be DNA, right? If it didn't have any thymine and it had uracil, then that would be evidence that this is an RNA molecule. Okay. All right, so this DNA has to unzip. It has to come apart. And when it comes apart, I see one strand of the DNA molecule here. And does that make sense? Is this DNA? What do you see right here? I see T's, right? So that confirms, indeed, this is a DNA strand. All right, and we're going to have an enzyme that's going to make an RNA molecule. Can you name that enzyme that makes an RNA molecule using this DNA right here as a template for making it? What's the name of that? That's a polymerase, and in particular, RNA polymerase, because it's going to make RNA. All right, so that RNA polymerase, okay, will put an adenine at this first location, the uracil at the second, and a guanine at the third position. And how does that RNA polymerase know to put these exact nucleotides at these exact locations? Yeah, base pairing rules with DNA, right? So the shape of these bases have to match up. All right, so then RNA polymerase is done. The RNA molecule comes on off, and this one strand of DNA goes back and joins with the antisense strand, and now you have a nice complete DNA molecule once again. And here you have a really long sequence of nucleotides. And each triplet, each three of these right here, represents an instruction to put an amino acid into a protein. Right? There's got to be three. Can't be one because you got 20 amino acids. All right, so here is an RNA molecule, and you know this is RNA because what do you see? Uracil. Okay. All right, so that DNA has come off. So now we see just a naked messenger RNA. But things can bind to this messenger RNA, and that is a transfer RNA. And could anybody tell me the sequence that a transfer RNA has to have to bind right at this location? The messenger RNA has a AUG. What would bind right here? It would be a UAC, right? And only a UAC will bind there. No other combination of nucleotides because of base pair rules. Okay, so a transfer RNA and a transfer RNA with that exact sequence will carry only one type of amino acid. Okay, and so that transfer RNA can only put an amino acid at this location because of base pair rules. So on a messenger RNA, this is what we call a codon. AUG is a codon. And something that will base pair to this codon is called an anticodon. And that, where do you find that anticodon? Is it on messenger RNA? No, it's on a transfer RNA. And joined to that transfer RNA, very specifically, is only one kind of amino acid. All right, so in this particular case, we have methionine in the first position. Then you got to go to the next triplet, right? That's the second codon that's going to call for glycine. And, ooh, does that make sense? Does GGC codon on a messenger RNA code for glycine? How would you check that? Go back to this universal genetic code. Ooh, what did I say? GGC. Do we have that GGC anywhere? Someplace? Oh, good. Okay, I see CCG. Ah, yeah, you're right. Very good. Okay, because here is what? The messenger RNA. And what did we have here? Messenger RNA. I was looking at the DNA. Yeah, here it is. GGC. That calls for glycine. Okay, and what could you tell me about an amoeba? What would an amoeba put at this location using this messenger RNA? What would an octopus, what kind of amino acid would an octopus put at this location in the protein that it's building? Exact same one, because it's the same genetic code, right, that has been conserved through evolution. Okay. But even though that's so amazing, I won't make you memorize that genetic code, even though it's so universal. Okay, so this is a nice figure because it shows you this first step, DNA going to RNA. What do we call that? Transcription happens in the nucleus. It also shows us how RNA, information in RNA, is converted into information in the protein, and we call that translation. And transcription happens in the nucleus, translation happens in the cytoplasm, and in particular, right on a ribosome, because that's the workbench where these amino acids are put together. Don't forget that workbench needs amino acids and it gets it from transfer RNA. So we got three kinds of RNA. We got the messenger RNA with codons, we have transfer RNA with anticodons, and then we have the ribosomal RNA that's the actual physical location where translation takes place. And maybe you could remember that RNA molecule. It had a tunnel going through it, and the tunnel is there because the messenger RNA has to go through that tunnel in order for these amino acids to be put into a protein. That's why that tunnel is there. All right, so here is an example of a transfer RNA. it kind of loops back on itself. So there are some short segments where it is double-stranded, but don't be confused. This is not a DNA molecule, even though it's double-stranded in a couple locations. That is just there to give this transfer RNA a particular shape, but also to put in this location here the anticodon. And this anticodon happens to be UUA, and it can bind to a messenger RNA only at one location. What's the location that this transfer RNA can bind to? If this is UUA, it's going to be on a messenger RNA, AAU, because of base pair rules. And when it does, this transfer RNA is bringing this particular amino acid, doesn't have a particular name right at the moment, to the ribosome to be put into a protein. I suppose with that universal genetic code, we could find out what amino acid belongs here. That would be a pretty fancy question for the test. So what would we do? We got the anticodon, but the universal genetic code works with the codon, so we'd have to do some base pair. We'd have to look in the universal genetic code for what? AAU, to find out what amino acid this transfer RNA is carrying around, bringing over to a ribosome. I see UUA right here. It's really small, right? But this is the anticodon. It pairs with the codon on the messenger RNA, which is AAU. And it's the triplet on the messenger RNA that is what we use for this universal genetic code, right? Here's messenger RNA. Messenger RNA has a codon. And what we see on the transfer RNA is the anticodon. So we got to work some base pair rules to find out what amino acid that is. Okay, so let's look at a little bit bigger picture. On this slide, I see a really long piece of RNA right here. And if we think of a really long piece of RNA, what kind of RNA is that going to be? A messenger RNA, right? It's going to contain the sequence of nucleotides that has the correct spelling for a protein that's being made. And don't forget, you need three bases to code for one amino acid. So here is, here's the first triplet, here's the second, right? And that messenger RNA is going through that tunnel in the ribosome. And remember, the job of the ribosome is to make a protein. So here I see a protein that's being made. Here's the number one amino acid. Here's the number two and number three. All right, so how many amino acids have been put into this protein already? Well, you could look at these codons. I have one, two, three, four. Here's the fourth codon. Here's the fourth amino acid. Here's the fifth codon. So here's the fifth amino acid. Right, so that shows that really nice correspondence. This transfer RNA has to bring that number five amino acid into the ribosome, and it knows to attach to the messenger RNA because of what? What is allowing this transfer RNA to bind to this messenger RNA? That base pair rules, right? Okay, so when the transfer RNA, number 5, enters the ribosome, then the ribosome catalyzes the reaction between amino acid number 4 and number 5. Right? So then amino acid number 5 is joined to number 4, and the ribosome moves down the messenger RNA one step, so that it reveals another triplet or another codon. All right, so in this particular case, just like that polysome, this ribosome is going to be moving down the messenger RNA. Okay, so here we see the base pair rules. And when the ribosome moves down one location, right, this transfer RNA right here no longer is holding on to the protein. It's released. And now this transfer RNA ends up at this location, and the process just repeats itself over and over and over again as the ribosome is moving down the messenger RNA. I wanted to say one thing. I forgot it twice while I was talking. Rats. Okay. So we have five amino acids now put into this protein, right, because an amino acid makes a protein. How many codons have been used to make this polypeptide with five amino acids in it? Five triplets, right? One, two, three, four, five. Just like that. Okay. All right, so what do we call this sequence of three nucleotide bases on a messenger RNA? That's the codon. What do we call the sequence of three nucleotides on a transfer RNA? The anticodon. And they match up exactly because of base pair rules. And they only match up, though, inside this ribosome, because the ribosome has the right structure to insert these things at the right location. Okay, so anticodon and codon. And what step of protein synthesis is this happening that I see right here? Yeah, it's translation, right? And you're really familiar with this bond between amino acid number 4 and number 5. Because why? Well, at least most people are really familiar with it. Because I could probably ask you to draw it out right now in class, because that is the assignment in lab, right? This is that peptide bond that is forming between two amino acids. Right, so that's one way to get this to be a little bit more familiar for you, right? To just draw that bond out. Okay, so the sequence of nucleotides in messenger RNA determines the sequence of amino acids put into a protein because of that universal genetic code and because of codons and anticodons working with each other can build this particular protein. All right, so in this particular case, I see a big membrane system right here, and there are some ribosomes that are attached to it. And what's the job of this ribosome once again? Yeah, to make a protein, right? Translation. Now the protein isn't, this ribosome isn't moving. But what do I see right here? I see a big, long, stringy molecule going right through that tunnel in a ribosome. This is the messenger RNA that contains what kind of beasts? The codons, right? Contains the codons. That's the dictionary on how to spell out a protein in amino acid letters. And in this particular case, the ribosome is fixed to the endoplasmic reticulum membrane, and now the messenger RNA is moving through, right? So the ribosome is fixed, but the messenger RNA is moving. This other thing that I showed you on a polysome was what? The messenger RNA was stationary, but the ribosomes are moving down. So either one or the other has to happen. In this particular case, notice here's a pore in the endoplasmic reticulum, and as the ribosome is building this protein, all right, it doesn't let it float out into the cytoplasm, it directs it into the cisternae of the endoplasmic reticulum. So now this protein, when it's made, is inside of an organelle inside the cell. It's not in the cytoplasm. And it has a different fate. So what's the fate of this protein that we see right here inside the endoplasmic reticulum? It's different than if it's being made by a free ribosome. Anybody remember what that is? What's the fate of a protein made by a free ribosome that's just out in the cytosol? It just stays in the cytoplasm or cytosol, right? Because that's where the ribosome is. But this one right here, since it's being built and then put into this organelle right away, where does it end up? It ends up in a vesicle that goes to the Golgi body, and then it gets modified in the Golgi body, put in another vesicle, and now that protein is in a vesicle inside an organelle, not in the cytosol. Okay, and that vesicle can be moved over to the plasma membrane, and that protein can be secreted outside of the cell. So the fate of this protein right here is either being secreted outside of the cell or put into a vesicle inside the cell, but never free in the cytosol. Yeah, hi. Okay, what don't you understand? Ask me a question.
I don't understand
this slide right here?
Yeah.
Okay. I see a ribosome. Okay, here's a ribosome, and what can you tell me about a ribosome? What do you know about a ribosome?
Protein.
Yeah, protein synthesis. That's a workbench where protein is being made. Okay, another thing you know about a ribosome is that it's made from ribosomal RNA, and a good way to think of that is that it needs two pieces of ribosomal RNA, and here I see those two pieces. All right, so this is not a competent ribosome, but it has some of the pieces that can be put together to make a ribosome. So these things move over to the messenger RNA and they glomp on, right? They just fit together and the messenger RNA goes through that little tunnel that's made right through here, right? So that's how all these ribosomes get on this molecule. And this really long molecule is the messenger RNA. It contains the codons, the correct sequence of nucleotides to make a protein. And as it moves through this ribosome, transfer RNAs bring amino acids to it. The transfer RNA binds to the messenger RNA according to base pair rules. And what does a transfer RNA bring to a ribosome? Amino acids, right? So it's bringing amino acids just at this one location. And after it makes that peptide bond between the amino acids right here, then the messenger RNA moves down one position. And that sequence can repeat itself over and over and over again until this messenger RNA goes through all of these ribosomes that are attached to the membrane. And because these ribosomes are attached to the membrane, as this protein is being made, it doesn't go in this direction, right? It doesn't go out into the cytoplasm. It gets directed through a pore into, it's not labeled right here, but this is just the cistern of a endoplasmic reticulum, some interior spot of the endoplasmic reticulum. And if it's in this spot here, oh, here's a cisterna of the endoplasmic reticulum, nice, right? And then when that protein is inside the endoplasmic reticulum, it can't get into the cytoplasm, okay? So it's inside this organelle, and then it's trapped in an organelle all the time. It gets the endoplasmic reticulum can form a vesicle with this protein in it, and that goes to a Golgi body. And then the protein is released inside the Golgi body where it's modified. Maybe a sugar molecule is added to it, or a lipid molecule. Works its way through the Golgi body, and then that modified protein is put into another vesicle, and that vesicle could stay inside the cell, or it could be moved over to the cell membrane, and then by exocytosis, that modified protein is released to the extracellular space. And I don't see that extracellular space right here, right? I just see translation happening, building this peptide, and you see it ending up inside the endoplasmic reticulum. And that determines its fate. It can never float around in the cytoplasm. It's either secreted from the cell or trapped inside of a vesicle. All right, well, what kind of vesicles do you know about? Do you know any types of vesicles? A name? Give me a name of a vesicle. Who knows a name? Lysosome. Yeah. What's the function of a lysosome? Ah, I tricked you. I was only asking you for the structure. But now, you got to tell me the function. What's the function of a lysosome? Digestion. That's right. And so you need a protein, an enzyme, to digest large molecules. And where does that protein come from that's inside the vesicle? It comes from translation that is happening on this endoplasmic reticulum, because that's the only way this protein can get inside that vesicle. If a free ribosome makes the protein, it can't enter that lysosome and digest whatever in the lysosome. It has to be made by rough endoplasmic reticulum. Somebody asked me that question. I know who it was. Hopefully I answered your question. Yeah. Right here. Both. Right here, because I see translation taking place, this is endoplasmic reticulum. And in particular, what kind? Is it smooth or rough? It's rough, because I see ribosomes. Golgi body never has ribosomes. It's going to look like smooth endoplasmic reticulum, but it doesn't function like smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Okay. So then these things here, these proteins move by vesicular transport from endoplasmic reticulum to, not smooth ER, but Golgi body. And Golgi body modifies the protein, puts it in another vesicle, and maybe that vesicle gets shipped over to the plasma membrane where that modified protein is released to the extracellular space. We call that secretion. Okay. So proteins aren't made by Golgi. And I think you should have a feel for that, because Golgi doesn't have ribosomes, right? Only rough endoplasmic reticulum or the cytosol. Oh, look what's here. Function of Golgi body. Probably talked about this slide already. The Golgi makes secretory proteins, right? These proteins leave the rough endoplasmic reticulum in vesicles, go to the Golgi body, and sometimes we call that a Golgi complex or Golgi apparatus. And the Golgi apparatus takes that protein and a carbohydrate, adds them together to make a glycoprotein. A glycoprotein is part sugar, part protein, and it has specific properties. A glycoprotein would be like, one example would be a mucopolysaccharide. A mucopolysaccharide is that stuff that drips out of your nose when you have a cold. Mucus, right, is a mucopolysaccharide. It's slippery, acts as a lubricant. It also acts as a buffer as well. What's a buffer? Stabilizes the pH of something. Yeah, so mucus does that as well. Okay. These vesicles leave the Golgi apparatus. They become lysosomes, or they're exocytosed. They're secreted outside the cell. Okay, let's go on to another topic, DNA replication. Well, why do we want to replicate DNA? Well, sometimes we have one cell and it divides into two identical cells. What do we call that process? That is mitosis, right? And mitosis is important for growth, and it's also important to replace old and damaged cells. Okay, but we said that the two cells that are produced, the daughter cells, are equal to each other. They're exactly the same. And compare that to the parent cell. What's the difference between a daughter cell and a parent cell? Are they different or are they the same? They're the same. Just like the daughter cells, they're the same. So, if you have a certain number of chromosomes in the parent cell, then the two daughter cells should have the exact same number of chromosomes. So if you have two cells with twice the number of chromosomes than the parent cell, what has to happen in the parent cell first? You've got to make another copy of that chromosome, right? So that the daughter cells get that full set of them. Does anybody know how many chromosomes are in a normal human cell? A regular, not a sex cell? Yeah, there's 46, right? So there's 46 in the parent cell, and then that means that there's 46 in both of the daughter cells. Right, so during interphase, that DNA has to be replicated. So there should be like two copies of that chromosome, so that when it divides, both of the daughter cells get each one copy, all 46. Right, so when a cell divides, DNA replicates itself, and identical copies go to the two daughter cells. That's just what I said. All right, so how does this happen? Well, what kind of structure does DNA have? Double helix, right? So double-stranded. DNA is double-stranded. The bases are pointing to the inside of the molecule. That's the information. When it's inside that helix, that information can't be read by anything inside the cell. So DNA, just like for RNA synthesis, the DNA molecule has to separate. And remember, is it easy to separate? Yeah, because they're just, what kind of bonds? Yeah, just hydrogen bonds holding it together. All right. So there is an enzyme that breaks those hydrogen bonds to produce these two free strands of DNA. So it's like an unzipperase. It unzips that big, long DNA molecule. Some other fancy things it does, because you remember DNA is really a twisted up molecule. It's got that double helix, and if you just unzip it, what do you have? You still have all those twists, right? And so a helicase can unwind the twists as well, so that it's a nice linear molecule. So it produces two single strands that are nice and straight, easy to work with. That another enzyme joins to that DNA molecule, actually both DNA molecules, and it starts to build a new DNA strand. Okay, and so it's going to build another polymer. So what would be the name of that enzyme that can make another DNA polymer from that initial DNA molecule? Yeah, it's a DNA polymerase, not an RNA, but it's a very similar kind of enzyme. Right? And so how does this DNA polymerase know what bases to add to that growing DNA molecule? By base pair rules. So the original strand is being used as a template to make the new strand because of these base pairing rules. Okay, so let's look at this. And then the rest of the description on the previous slide you'll see. So what do you have up over here on this slide? Double strand, thymine, I see DNA, right? And are the base pair rules obeyed right here? I see an AT and a GC. Yeah, okay? That has to happen. Otherwise, that double helix can't even form. The molecules can't, the two strands can't even come together. All right, so we have a helicase that does what? Unzips and also takes out some of these twists. That's not shown on the slide, but it makes a nice linear sequence. And then an RNA molecule binds and starts to move down the DNA molecule right here, and it's going to insert more nucleotides as it moves, and that sequence of nucleotides has to match up by base pairing rules to the strand of DNA. See? That's done by the DNA polymerase. And it keeps working and working and working. So this base on DNA, okay, is going to make a second strand with a cytosine at this particular location. So the first strand is acting like a template to make a new strand over here. All right, the other thing happens with the other strand. So both strands are important in DNA. There isn't one that is a nonsense strand, like in for transcription, right? Because DNA is always a double helix. It's double-stranded. So both strands have to be replicated. And, of course, the base pair rules have to be the same. So here I see two old strands making up this old DNA molecule. But what can you tell me about this new DNA molecule here and here? Where do these strands come from? In each of these, one strand is from the old DNA molecule, and one strand is a, absolutely brand new DNA molecule. What about over here? One strand is absolutely from the old DNA, and the other one is completely new. All right? In both these cases, that DNA has one old strand and one new strand, and when we see that, okay, we call that semi-conservative replication, because the DNA molecule isn't broken in part, but each new double helix has one new strand that I see right here and one old strand. You don't end up with a DNA molecule with two new strands and the second one with two old strands. Right? It's half and half. Okay. And the reason why you want two of these DNA molecules is why? Why is this being replicated? So that when a cell undergoes mitosis, one daughter cell gets this complete DNA molecule, and the other daughter cell gets this one over here, and so they still have the exact same number of chromosomes that the parent cell had, which is this one right here. That's why there's DNA replication. That happens during interphase. Okay, so you learned about a helicase. How do you know that's an enzyme? A helicase. ASE at the end of the word, just some nomenclature. Right? How do you know that DNA polymerase is an enzyme? ASE at the end of its name. Okay, so here is cell cycle. Probably don't even have to talk about this one because I'm sure you've gone over this a lot in anatomy classes. Okay, but let's go over just a little bit. Here's a good example. Pretty good example. There's a figure like this in your anatomy textbook. Maybe you didn't use it too much. But this circle right here represents the whole life cycle of a cell. Okay? And part of this life cycle, I see interphase. So from all of this region right here, the shading kind of looks like a blue color. That represents interphase. That's the phase that the cell spends most of its time in. This is the phase where the cell is doing whatever job it should be doing. If it's an endocrine cell, it's making a hormone and secreting that hormone. Right, but at a certain time, maybe it has to divide to replace old or damaged endocrine cells. So it has to divide by mitosis to produce an exact duplicate. All right, so here we see the phases of mitosis. Right, and you probably memorize these. The correct sequence is something like IPMAT. Right, I stands for interphase. The first phase of mitosis is prophase. The second phase is metaphase, and anaphase, and telophase. And so what's happening during these different phases, you should have a pretty good idea of what's happening. Prophase is when we have extended chromatin, like I see in the cell in interphase. The DNA is being used. Okay, it's condensed into chromosomes that I can see right here. So instead of really long filamentous molecules, they've all been wrapped up on what kind of protein? This extended chromatin is wrapped up on a specific kind of protein. It's called a histone. And it's packaged into chromosomes, and when it's wrapped up on that histone, then it becomes a very stable molecule. It's hard to damage. And because you have chromosomes with very stable DNA, look at that organelle that normally holds the genetic material. What do we call this organelle right here? That's the nucleus. All right, so what's one step in this one thing that's happening during prophase? The nuclear membrane starts to disappear. Extended chromatin condenses into chromosomes. Those are some pretty important steps. Also, the spindle apparatus, right? Almost kind of looks like a basketball here. But here we have a centrosome. Here is a centrosome. They control microtubules, remember? And microtubules then go from one centrosome to the other, and these centrosomes are on opposite poles of the cell. And the last thing that happens during prophase is that the chromosomes, actually the replicated chromosomes, attach themselves to the microtubules, or they get attached. Right? I don't think you have to know one way or the other. So what's the function of a microtubule once again? Yeah, transport. It's moving things around. So once a chromosome attaches to a microtubule, that microtubule is going to start to move it around inside the cell. And how does it do that? It does it by making all the chromosomes line up exactly at the middle of the cell. That's the easiest phase of mitosis to see underneath the microscope, and we call that middle phase or metaphase, right? So when the chromosomes line up right here at the equator of the cell, that's metaphase. Now what happens? I see, at least from my vantage point, that this chromosome right here looks like an X. Can you see that this kind of looks like an X? Okay. And we call that a chromosome, but what it actually is a replicated chromosome. Right? There's one chromosome that looks like that, and then the replicated chromosome gets attached to it, and it forms kind of like a X. So there's two copies of that chromosome attached to each other, and people just call that a chromosome. But remember, there's two copies of every chromosome now inside the cell. If I look over here, here's that X. Right? So this is what we call a chromatid. And then over here is the sister chromatid. These chromatids are identical to each other, right? Due to DNA replication. They're attached right here at the centromere. During prophase, microtubules attach to the centromere. This is where they attach to. And then they get pushed and pulled around to that metaphase, they're right on the equator. Then in anaphase, then this sister chromatid separates from this one. But remember, they're an exact copy of each other. Each of these then end up in a different daughter cell. So once they start to separate, they're no longer called chromatids. They're called daughter chromosomes. Daughter chromosomes. Okay, here you can see some extended chromatin, some histone molecules. Okay, so let's go back to this slide. So here you have, now you got those X's separating from each other. So those replicated chromosomes are separating, being pulled to opposite poles of the cell. And when they get over to the centrosome, okay, then that's pretty much the end of mitosis. That's the end stage. We call that telophase. And actually, telo means the end of something. And then the cell starts to pinch apart. We call that a cleavage furrow. The nuclear envelope starts to reappear. That nuclear envelope, remember, protects the DNA, protects the genetic material, so it can go from a condensed form to an extended form. And in order for DNA to be useful to the cell, it has to be in an extended form. In order for a transcription to take place, it has to be an extended form. But we don't want to extend chromatin in the cytoplasm. We want to extend chromatin in the nucleus because the nucleus protects it from degradation. Right? If it extends in the cytoplasm, then it can be damaged. Right? Genes will be lost, and then that would be the death of the cell. All right, so the nuclear envelope starts to reappear. Then we see it start to pinch apart, right, with this little furrow, a little depression working all the way around between these two cells. And then that depression gets deeper and deeper and deeper, and then finally this one cell splits into two cells. That happens during telophase. And so I sort of like this diagram a little bit, but not exactly. Okay, the splitting apart of one cell into two, okay, is what we call cytokinesis. So I want you to think of cytokinesis as the separation of cytoplasm into two separate cells. Right? But mitosis is the separation of what material? Genetic material into two separate cells. And these things can happen inside each other. And as a matter of fact, I would like for you to know that cytokinesis happens within telophase. Not after telophase. I think even the description in your textbook says cytokinesis happens within telophase. This illustration kind of doesn't show that. Okay, but it's important for you to know that cytokinesis has a different meaning compared to mitosis. So I guess I would ask you a question. Cytokinesis is the separation of what into two daughter cells? Cytoplasm, right? Because now, and what is cytoplasm? Organelle, so you got some mitochondria over here, some mitochondria over here, right? And you got some Golgi over here, got some Golgi over here. Both daughter cells have the exact same material. But mitosis is what? The separation of genetic material into two separate cells. So I think that's a convenient way to think about these two different terms. All right, interphase is very long. It has some phases. It's got G1, S, and G2. G1, some organelles replicate themselves, right? Because if the cytoplasm is going to split, you need two copies of every organelle or somebody's going to miss out on one. So here it says centrioles replicate. During this S phase, that's when DNA is replicated. And then the last phase, G2, that's kind of like the final growth phase, but at that time DNA should be replicated, organelles should be replicated. But in G2, the cell checks to make sure that everything is replicated. It goes through a checklist of all the things that it needs before the cell divides. And if it doesn't have the right number of chromosomes, then it doesn't go into mitosis. And the cell might die, or maybe it will try to get the right number of chromosomes. Okay, so that's the job of G2. Okay, so that is the whole cell cycle. So you got to know the phases of mitosis, but of course the correct order of those different phases. Like, what's the first phase of mitosis? Yeah, prophase. That's like primavera phase, yeah. Yeah, we call this a chromosome. But you know what? It's a replicated chromosome. So here is what you started with, or half of what you started with, and then over here is the other half of what you started with after it's been replicated by that semi-conservative replication. We call it a chromosome, but you have to realize it's what? It's really two identical copies of one chromosome. So that when it splits apart, both daughter cells get a complete chromosome, an exact complete chromosome. Right, and it attaches to this centromere right here. The tip, this tip of a chromosome right over here, we call these the telomeres. The telomeres of a chromosome. And it just so happens that the DNA polymerase can't replicate the DNA at the very tip of a DNA molecule. Right, so these two DNA molecules, this chromosome right here, is a little bit shorter than the parent chromosome. And every time the cell undergoes mitosis, this chromosome gets shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. Yeah, it actually kind of disappears. Right? And we think that's really important because there's some cells in our body we don't want to live forever. Because what kind of tissue? Could you think of some kind of tissue that has a tendency never to die, never go away? It just keeps growing and growing and growing and growing, like a cancer cell. Right? So cancer cells are not sensitive to losing this telomere, and they have the ability to undergo mitosis for many, many, many generations. So when you lose that ability to control that cell, that can produce cancer. And I got a couple slides right at the end of this chapter. Right? So here's that telomere. It controls how long a cell line can live inside your body. Okay, so here are those four phases of mitosis. Right, so you got to know some things about each of these different phases. We went over that. And what phase does cytokinesis take place in? Yeah, for anything that I'll test you on, it's going to be within telophase. Right? Okay. That's really not shown very well on that illustration, right? It's kind of shown here after telophase. And it's a little bit more complicated than that. Some cells at under certain conditions maybe start to undergo cytokinesis during anaphase. The cell starts to split apart and then finishes up during telophase. All right, so, and scientists will be discussing when cytokinesis takes place, under what conditions and what cells, for probably at least 100 years. And you have to take an exam before 100 years is up. So we're just going to define cytokinesis to happen when? During telophase, right? But you might want to, if somebody says not, don't think that they're completely wrong, because they might be right under certain circumstances. Yeah.
What's the difference with chromatin and chromatin?
Okay. Chromatin is this material right here. It's this form of DNA that's extremely long. Yeah, so that's like the building block of a chromosome. Okay, chromatin is
is what a chromosome is made up of. And you have DNA, and then also you have some histones. What kind of molecule is a histone? Anybody remember? Is it a sugar, a protein, a nucleic acid, or lipid? Protein, right. So you take some of that genetic material, right? You take this, the DNA molecule, combine it with a protein, and that's what makes, right, and then when it wraps around that histone, that forms condensed chromatin. And if you have all that condensed chromatin together in one location, that's what we call a chromosome. And chromosomes, we can usually see when they're in a condensed form like that underneath a microscope. So if we look at a normal cell, how many of these X's would we see? We would see 46. Yeah, 46. Before mitosis, there would be 46 in there. And that's sort of a routine thing done in hospitals, right, for prenatal care, just to see if the fetus has the correct number of chromosomes, right? And if they are, and you can tell exactly what chromosome it is, if it's number one, number two, number three, and then you can diagnose what chromosome is missing, and then you could maybe help figure out what would happen to this individual if it went to term. And if they're missing a chromosome, usually that's a fatal aberration, but sometimes people live through that, okay? So that's an important diagnostic test. A chromatid is when you have these two replicated chromosomes together joined at a centromere. So I see one chromatid over here and the second one over here. And since they're joined together before anaphase, we call these sister chromatids. The chromatids are just replicated chromosomes exactly the same joined together at the centromere. That's a chromatid. So a chromatid is a chromosome made up of chromatin. Yeah, chromatin, right? So here's chromatin. And chromatin makes a chromosome. When you replicate that chromosome, you end up with sister chromatids. And then when these sister chromatids separate, then we call those daughter chromosomes. Daughter chromosomes, yeah.
Are those two chromatids connected by, are they like spacing by up and down, or left and right?
Here's up and down like this. Here's one chromosome. Okay, is that right? I don't know, that's an interesting question. Okay, I would say here's one chromosome, here's the other. So they're separated left to right on this illustration. Yeah. Okay, so those are the phases. There's something about these phases you should be aware of. I don't think I have these. Do I have these as exam figures for you? I don't think I do. So I won't ask you to tell me what phase of mitosis this is, but you could probably tell me right now without reading the slide. Does this look like mitosis to you to start with? Yeah, it's mitosis. I see a nice spindle apparatus. I see two areas where there are chromosomes. These are what we call daughter chromosomes. I see a nice dropout of signal in between them. That means that the sister chromatids are separating into daughter chromosomes. And that happens during anaphase. So if you see this, that would be anaphase. What phase do they all line up at the center of the cell, equator of the cell? That's metaphase, right? And now I see that cleavage furrow developing, and cytokinesis is taking place during telophase, right? Okay, so don't forget, these centrioles right here control those microtubules, where they go and how they behave. So the centrioles are important in building and controlling that spindle apparatus. And remember that those microtubules are important for moving things around inside the cell, so they're going to be moving these daughter chromosomes around to opposite poles of the cell. Okay. And they're replicated during G1. I think I mentioned that already. They move to opposite poles during metaphase. Actually, that happens during prophase even. And it just controls the spindle apparatus and the attachment of chromosomes to the spindle apparatus. All right, telomere. Oh, what does telomere mean once again? The end of something. And a telomere is a location. Telomere is a location. So it's the end or a tip of something. And we said it's the tip of a chromosome, right? So these aren't important. Telomeres don't have genes. They're non-coding regions, right, at the tips of chromosomes. But each time the cell divides, some length of that telomere is lost,
because that DNA polymerase can't work at the end of that DNA molecule. Right? So every time a cell undergoes mitosis, the chromosome gets shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And the cell, as it gets shorter, right, it becomes senescent. Oh, what does that mean? It becomes senescent. It means it gets old, right? It gets old and kind of useless, and then the cell dies. And so that losing the tip of that telomere every time mitosis takes place, we think that's like a molecular clock that tells the cell how old it is, right, and when it can be useful, when it can't be useful. So each time that cell or that cell line undergoes mitosis, that's like one tick of a clock. Okay, and if a cell doesn't have that clock, then it will basically live forever, right, and become a cancer cell if that cell division can't be controlled. All right, that's because of the telomere. So those cells can divide indefinitely. They don't age. Okay, cancer cells have an enzyme called telomerase, and of course you know that's an enzyme. Cancer cells have this enzyme, and it can rebuild the lost telomeres whenever a cell divides. That's why that cell can undergo many, many more stages of mitosis, right, than a normal cell, because those telomeres get rebuilt by telomerase. And so a lot of people are really interested with this telomerase, because if you can inhibit telomerase, what would happen? Let's see if we can follow what the thought is there. Okay, what does this telomerase do? It rebuilds a complete chromosome back so that it never gets shorter. That's what telomerase does. That allows a cell line to live, right, indefinitely. So if that telomerase was inhibited to some degree, what would happen to that chromosome? It would start to get shorter, like it normally would, right? So that would be a really super way to treat cancer, just by inhibiting this enzyme right here. And lots of people are interested in learning how to do that. Okay, so that's just one possible track for dealing with cancers. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Every time a cell undergoes mitosis, right, something has to happen. You start with one chromosome. It has to be replicated, right, so that the two daughter cells get a complete chromosome. And when that chromosome is replicated, right, and forms that little X molecule like that, the tips get lost. The ends of that chromosome get lost. And the second time that cell undergoes mitosis, then that chromosome even loses some more of the tip, which we call the telomere. And there gets to a point in time when so much of the end of the chromosome is lost that the DNA polymerase can't work. It can't reproduce that chromosome anymore because it's gotten too short. And at that time, then the cell is going to die because it's missing genes, right? It can't undergo mitosis. That cell line is going to disappear as a result of that. Okay. Cancer cells, on the other hand, have an enzyme that can rebuild that tip that's being lost every time. So that cell can undergo mitosis, and the telomere doesn't get shorter. It stays the same length. When that cell undergoes mitosis again, the tips get shorter, but it has polymerase, builds it back to where it was before. So even after thousands of generations, that chromosome doesn't get any shorter. Right? It has the same size, right? It has all the same genes at the very beginning, so that cell doesn't die as a result, because the chromosomes don't get any shorter. The enzyme in cancer cells that makes sure the chromosome doesn't get any shorter is telomerase. So if that cancer cell loses telomerase, then every time it undergoes mitosis, okay, it loses some of the chromosome, and it's marching its way to cell death, which is a normal process for cells. Okay, ask me another question. Meiosis. That's not on your slides. Okay. So that is something about telomeres and chromosomes and telomerase. Right? So DNA polymerase can't replicate a complete chromosome exactly from one tip to the other. Right? Every time a cell undergoes mitosis, that DNA polymerase always misses the tip of each chromosome. So the chromosome gets shorter and shorter and shorter. And I wish I had a picture. I wish I had a picture of all the chromosomes inside. This is pretty interesting for you. Some people seem shocked that the chromosomes get shorter and shorter and shorter every time it replicates. And maybe on the next, we got a couple minutes. I got to show you this. All right. So I want to go to. I got to go to the internet. Some people had a question about conversion factors, like how many feet of water are equal to one atmosphere, right? And so I just did a Google on conversion feet of water to atmospheres, and you could put like from feet, I got 1 foot here, is equal to how many atmospheres? 0.029. Okay, or you could go the other way. You could put 1 foot, right, or one atmosphere is what, 33 feet of water. Okay, so you can do this convert. Your textbook might have that same thing in the back. Okay, but that's not what I'm interested in. What I want to do right now, go to Google and type in. Because somebody was interested in these chromosomes that are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Okay, that's a pretty good picture of chromosomes. We could count these out. Let's kind of count these out. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And if we were to count all of those out, we would count how many? 46, right? Because you've got pairs of every single one. These are really long, so we know these are the number one. The ones that are a little bit shorter are the number two. And as they get shorter and shorter, they have different numbers of genes, right? And they just have a different number. Here's number 46. What can you tell me about this pair of chromosomes, number 46? Are they identical? Are they the same length? Indeed, they're not, okay? And this is the difference between male and females. In females, this number 46 chromosome will be the same length. But in males, one of them will be really, really short. Okay, so that is happening, and we think that chromosome right here is getting shorter and shorter and shorter as time goes on. So where there might be a time when a male will only have one chromosome, this one will completely disappear. I'm not sure we all know what's going to happen at that point in time. Probably have some medical genetic manipulations we can perform. But anyway, I would like to instruct that all you ladies in the class should be really sensitive to males because, what, we're deficient in that one chromosome, okay, and need special attention to make up for that missing chromosome. Okay, so that's it. So this is what we call a karyotype. This is what? Condensed chromatin right here. All right, and if somebody has two long chromosomes like that, they're female, right? If they have, this is a Y, here's an X. If they're YY, they're female. If you're XY, then you're male. And so that's also sort of describes why some abnormalities males only have, like color blindness, or why it can skip from one generation to another, because the gene for color blindness exists on the Y chromosome, and the male only has one location. So if it has the aberrant gene for that abnormality, then they have that is expressed. But in a female, right, they have one location and then another location on the other chromosome, the other Y chromosome. And in order, if there's one normal gene, then the female won't be colorblind. But they can pass that gene on to their offspring. Right? So colorblindness can hop generations. Right? And you always inherit it from your mom. There's another one that's like that too. I think hemophilia is like that. But I forgot exactly. Okay. So, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. But we have an announcement from SI.
Hi, guys. So, I was able to get a room for an extra session tomorrow. So, the information that's going to be up here is going to be 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. That was the majority of the votes that I got. So, extra session tomorrow. It's going to be in 308. It's not the same room that we've been having at SI. So, next week on Tuesday, right before the test, I will be having my regular SI at 9:30. In the same meeting room at 317 in the business building. But on Thursday, there will be no SI since no material will be covered on Tuesday.
No new material.
Right?
You're right, no new material on Tuesday.